Robert Stark here, joined here with Bay Area Guy. Hey, how's it going?
Doing great. It's great to be back on the show again.
So, first of all, I want to say congrats for writing for Alternative Right.
Yes, thank you. I believe that four of my articles have been reposted on that site, and they've been generating more and more comments. So, I'm glad to be getting some of that recognition.
So your latest post there is called a Postcolonial Selective Outrage, and yeah, I guess you want to start off by saying that you start off by saying that you're gonna cut the Israelis some slack.
Yes, definitely an uncommon sentiment within the alternative right.
Except for
But essentially,
John Engelman.
oh yes, a few exceptions notwithstanding. But essentially, the reason why I wrote that article is because, believe it or not, a lot of liberal Zionists and Israeli apologists are correct when they insist that many within the left and various social justice camps are indeed being hypocritical when they single out Israel for special condemnation, because in fact there are a lot of other abusers out there, and including powers that promote colonial settler movements, such as China, most notably when it comes to their colonization of Tibet as well as the homeland of the Uyghurs.
And I want to point out, you emphasize the left as opposed to people, say, in the alternative right.
Well, the reason why I did that was because when the alternative right and the left criticize Israel, they have very differing, their motivations significantly differ. When the alternative right criticizes Israel, they're essentially doing it to highlight the hypocrisy of the organized Jewish community and sort of this discrepancy between the multiculturalism that Jewish groups promote in the diaspora West versus the ethno-nationalism they endorse for Israel. However, when the left criticizes Israel, they're doing it from the standpoint of sort of an anti-colonial or post-colonial perspective. They place the Israel-Palestine conflict within the general framework of evil white settlers oppressing, displacing, and colonizing poor indigenous brown people.
And they
And,
view, they view Israel as an offshoot of a European colonialism.
essentially, yes. And even though demographically nowadays Israel's predominantly non-white, the original architects of Zionism and the remaining elites in Israel today are predominantly Ashkenazi Jews. And I even went so far as to argue in my article that if the original architects of Zionism were Middle Eastern brown-skinned Mizrahi Jews as opposed to the white Ashkenazim, very few people on the left would care because it wouldn't fit that narrative of white settlers versus noble, oppressed brown natives. It would just be another brown-on-brown Middle Eastern conflict, which few people care about.
And I mean, you point out the example of China, for instance, because you had a post on your site, China too big and non-white to oppose.
Essentially, yeah. And I think the reason why China has been able to more or less get away with its current colonial settler enterprises is because, one, they indeed have become too big and powerful to oppose for many. You know, many Western nations have lucrative business arrangements with China. They're not about to antagonize their ally over a group of Turkic Muslim Uyghurs, especially in today's post-9/11 climate. And also, since from the standpoint of the left, since China's not white and has historically been on the receiving end of a few instances of Western imperialism, they don't really fit the oppressor narrative. I mean, a few free Tibet types notwithstanding, China has been able to more or less get away with its current policies.
And I mean, in the past, other examples would be Japanese imperialism or the Ottoman Empire.
Oh, of course. And I mean, one only has to compare the extensive coverage of German crimes in World War II versus the very scant coverage of Japanese crimes such as the rape of Nanking, the Bataan Death March, Unit 731, which conducted some rather horrific human experimentation. But despite having to, you know, adopt a pacifist constitution and renounce the title of emperor, Japan has been able to, more or less, just fade into obscurity and not really have to answer for its crimes or alter its nationalistic identity in the same way that Germany has. And with regards to the Ottoman Empire, well, hardly anyone even knows about the Balkans nowadays or even regards people of the Balkans as victims of non-Western imperialism for around 5 centuries. I guess victims of colonialism only count if they're of color.
So basically to summarize this article, you're saying that Israel's being singled out for being white.
Yes, essentially. It's not that Jews are finally being held to the same moral standards as Western nations when it comes to the treatment of the other. It's just that they're being criticized within the anti-racist framework that criticizes white people. So their Jewishness is still being left intact and relatively unscathed. They're just being lumped in with regular white people. And you see this in other instances as well. For example, one of the articles I wrote was about Tal Fortgang, the Princeton student who wrote an essay denouncing the whole concept of white privilege. And he invoked his Jewish background as a way of sort of rendering himself immune to that accusation, saying, oh, I'm not privileged. My grandfather was a Holocaust survivor. And yet, whenever people on the left criticized him, they would always highlight his whiteness, saying that, oh, he's just another privileged, entitled white boy, typical white person.
Or Donald Sterling's the other example.
Oh, yes, and Sterling's not even his real last name. It's Tokowitz. And what's funny about Sterling is that when people took Sterling to task for the racist comments he made in the presence of his mistress / girlfriend, he actually said that, you know, why are you coming after me? Just look at the way Israelis treat blacks.
Yeah, I did say that.
I guess Sterling's an aspiring alternative right writer.
Yeah, we could certainly use his funding.
Yeah, it would certainly go a long way. Let's see if he maybe tosses us a bone after he sells the Clippers.
You can write him a letter.
But, hey, he's growing senile. He might be persuaded to accept.
Yeah. And you also wrote about, you had an article about Sweden, and you made a comparison in Sweden, how Sweden had a very minor role in colonialism.
And I wouldn't just say even minor, it had an almost insignificant role.
It perhaps controlled... It was the island of St. Bart's they originally owned.
Yeah, and that's basically the only real colony that Sweden could boast of. And they had, at most, minor involvement in any imperialist or colonialist endeavor. And yet, according to these critics on the left, its minor involvement somehow renders it, you know, forever guilty, forever tainted with this original sin. And therefore, in order to atone for this original sin, they must open up their borders and accept being displaced. In fact, I even remember this video where Jesse Jackson was speaking in Sweden.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
He was talking about Sweden. Yeah, and he was talking about Sweden's involvement in the slave trade and how, because of its involvement in the slave trade in the past, it now must become tolerant and, you know, not succumb to nationalist impulses. So there you have it. If any white person at any point in history has done something bad acting on behalf of their nation, then that nation, centuries into the future, is essentially tainted and cannot defend its identity. So, yeah, there's no statute of limitations when it comes to redress for white sins, real or imagined.
And what were some of the reactions you got from that alt-right article?
Well, it seemed to, a lot of it sort of resulted in this debate regarding the left's attitude towards Israel. And some people were arguing that, you know, the left in general favors the underdog. It has nothing to do with hating whites. And someone also went on a rant about how someone was an Aspie and he attributed too much influence to some Jewish cabal rather than recognizing that it's just a lot of basic forces at work. And
yeah, some of that stuff it comes across as kind of kooky, I guess.
Yeah. I am a little disappointed that the article didn't really focus much on the main point about Chinese colonialism, but instead sort of devolved into a debate about Jewish influence and whether or not it's Jewish power or inherent Western egalitarianism that produces the mess we complain about, and the usual debates.
Yeah, the whole debate going on, yeah. Before I move on to your next article, is there anything else that could be added about that, or that's basically it?
About the reaction specifically?
Yeah, the reactions and just the topic, I guess the topic of the current, do you have anything to say about the current conflict going on there in the Middle East?
Well, currently Israel has been bombarding Gaza and sort of turning it into a grave. And I guess I'm just wondering, at one point will Israel actually be regarded as a pariah in the same manner that apartheid South Africa was? How many more people do they have to kill and how many more international laws do they have to flout before people finally say, enough is enough, and the hell with Jewish sensibilities. We have to hold Israel accountable in the same way that we would hold a white Gentile nation that was acting in a similar manner.
So your next article, your other article, I guess, is the one about, it's about France, victory from the land of the cheese-eating surrender monkeys. You have that video from The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah, the groundskeeper Willie.
Yeah.
With his thick Scottish accent, speaking in French. Yeah, I've always liked The Simpsons, and that's sort of where I got the reference from. And, the French are kind of an interesting case because, as I point out, a lot of people deride the French for their supposedly effeminate and wimpy ways and are often regarded as these effete cheese eaters and wine drinkers.
Especially around the time of the Iraq invasion when they had freedom fries.
Oh, God.
And all that.
Utterly ridiculous.
But they're way ahead of we are in terms of what's going on there. And, I mean, group, they have the elections with Le Pen and the Front National. They have a generation identity. I mean, they're so far ahead of anything in the United States.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the United States wouldn't have anything even approaching the National Front. I mean, not without being branded a hate group by the SPLC and then driven into the underground. But the French actually deserve a lot of credit for what they've done, both in terms of history and currently. I mean, for starters, they held the line at the Battle of Tours. I mean, all these right-winger types who promote freedom fries would be humbled to know that if it weren't for the French, all of Western Europe would have been overrun by the very Muslim Arabs that they now despise. And, of course, we also can't forget their assistance during the Revolutionary War, and now they seem to be leading the charge with regards to nationalism. So far from being a bunch of feckless, cheese-eating surrender monkeys, the French have been doing a lot of things right, and they've also provided a valuable lesson with regards to successful conservative activism. They've demonstrated that through relentless pressure and organizing, certain fruity liberal initiatives can be defeated. And the latest example of a fruity liberal initiative being defeated was the French government sought to impose this bizarre gender-bending curricula in schools where they would have boys... Well, for example, take the classic Little Red Riding Hood. They'd have the boys play the heroine, or they'd have the girls play the wolf. And just the general gender-bending, gender's a social construct, and boys shouldn't be associated with toughness and girls not with softness, the usual crap. But the French decided to say no to that. They decided to organize against it. And of course, the greatest thing about all of this is that this mission was spearheaded by a woman of Algerian descent, Farida Belghoul. So of course, that puts the left in a very uncomfortable bind, because, you know, she's a minority and a woman. You have to be careful about criticizing her.
And you even touched upon that theme in that article you had about the Bay Area. You touched on that same theme.
Oh, yeah. I mean, something has to give. And as we're starting to see, it's beginning to give more and more. Because essentially, what you have both in the U.S. and in Europe, you have large groups of immigrants who are coming and radically altering the demographic makeup of those respective regions. In the U.S., it's primarily Latinos. In Europe, it's primarily various Muslim ethnic groups. And they tend to support the left, obviously, as racial minorities and as a group heavily comprised of immigrants. They do it purely out of self-interest. Because when you're a poor minority group, you want to support the party that favors big government and various social programs. However, that does not mean that they in any way, shape, or form endorse the various loony pet causes of the social justice warrior left, you know, because those cultures tend to be traditionally conservative. And if you were to ask the random Latino or Muslim person if they endorsed feminism or if they endorsed raising their kids genderless, they probably look at you like you were insane. So I think we're going to see more and more tension between non-whites and white feminist elites. And we already see it with regards to feminist spaces. For example, there was a recent controversy where Jezebel hired a new chief editor who was this thin, attractive white woman over a more qualified, experienced black woman. And you had various black media outlets like the Griot sort of voicing complaints about it and saying that, oh, solidarity really is for white women. So I don't think that this leftist coalition is going to last for much longer, because without a common white male enemy to fulminate against, well, we'll really hold them together. And we're beginning to see that collapse.
And you mentioned in this article that you say you often feel that the alternative right always comes across as the bearer of bad news and always warning about total collapse, cultural collapse, very pessimistic.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't to say that a lot of these articles by the alternative right are incorrect. I mean, we do indeed live in trying times, but both for practical reasons and also, you know, just general common sense, it doesn't make sense to always be sort of the bearers of bad news, because one, Americans especially, they like a winner. They like sort of a righteous rebel. They don't like people who wallow in self-pity or gloom and doom. And then also, as this latest victory in France demonstrates, the left can indeed be defeated. They're not some omnipotent, monolithic force that will just crush everything before it. And if conservatives gather their energy, and if they rally together, they can make their voices heard. And perhaps France can even serve as an example for how to engage in successful conservative activism.
And you also have an article about the border situation, saving the children while losing your nation, immigrant children, imperialism, and irresponsible elitism, and again, you also have a Simpsons picture for that article.
Yeah, I guess in case it's not already known now, I am a fan of The Simpsons. I think it's actually, despite the fact that a lot of people complain about its portrayal of Homer and how it bashes men, I think it's actually a brilliant satire of the general cultural rot of the United States.
I mean, you can make that argument, but I mean, I think a lot of American men are pretty pathetic. I think a lot of them sort of are like, you have a lot of Homer Simpsons types who like Homer Simpson, but without the humor.
Homer Simpson without the humor. That's a way to put it. But of course, The Simpsons also doesn't really, it also criticizes many female characters. I mean, Marge is a feckless housewife. Her sisters are these unattractive spinsters.
Yeah.
Bart's teacher's crazy, so.
Or Bart's teacher, is Bart's teacher kind of, was she like a spinster?
Well, for a while she was, yeah.
Oh, yeah, or Marge's sisters are the spinsters, and then Lisa Simpson is kind of, but she's intelligent, but sometimes she plays a sort of a stereotype of a feminist. And then
the
character,
sort of an unlikable know-it-all.
Yeah, and you have the preacher's wife, who's the one who's always saying, won't somebody please think of the children? So all, I mean, yeah, no, you don't have to take it too seriously. All the characters play off some kind of stereotype.
Oh, yeah. But within certain stereotypes, there are ingrained certain nuggets of truth. And this definitely applies to child worship. You know, and it's not just a recent phenomenon caused by baby boomers and helicopter parenting. As Richard Hofstadter in his book Anti-Intellectualism in American Life pointed out, children have always been venerated to some degree in the United States, whether it's in terms of educational policy, or he even noted that 19th century European travelers to the United States noted that parents were very indulgent towards their children. And of course, child worship is again being trotted out here in the whole immigration debate. And it's a perfect weapon, too, because, you know, how can you oppose more immigration without looking like a child-hating racist? It's very difficult to do so. So this debate is not actually about the children themselves, but rather more and more white Americans are getting sick of the broken immigration system and the federal government's unwillingness to actually enforce border security.
And, yes, I see that comment by that guy Tulio. He says what irritates him is how the word immigrant has become so cheapened. What are your thoughts on his comment?
Well, essentially he's correct because, you know, generally when you think of someone who's an immigrant, you think of someone who has taken the process to immigrate legally, learn the language, assimilate, you know, and become an American. But as he pointed out, nowadays, just about anyone who shows up on the American doorstep is an immigrant and thus entitled to the full benefits of citizens. And as Tulio also pointed out, if immigrants are arriving in large numbers and they don't assimilate, then they're basically colonists. And the American Southwest is slowly but surely becoming a de facto colony of Mexico.
But colonialists can only be white.
Oh, of course. I mean, the Mexicans are just coming back to their land that was stolen from them. So they automatically have a right to the land.
And Tulio, is he a blogger or is he just a commenter?
He's an old commenter that I knew on Robert Lindsay's blog. He's a black guy who's more a moderate, more a center-left, but generally pretty open-minded and, like me, exasperated about the broken immigration system and the unwillingness to actually enforce border regulations.
So he's kind of, you describe him as closer to Robert Lindsay than to you.
Probably. But, I mean, Robert Lindsay also tends to be exasperated with immigration, which is pretty rare for a self-identified leftist like him.
And he calls, yeah, he identifies as a leftist, but the left would probably say he's not actually a leftist. Oh, he's a fascist.
Robert Lindsay, a fascist. Never would have imagined.
I think was it the comment of who's this? I think the comment on our last show described him as the left wing of the alternative right.
Essentially, yeah.
And he's totally sui generis. I mean, there's no one else out there comparable to him. Who's a blogger? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who think like him, but he's totally one of a kind.
Oh yeah, and that's what attracted me to his blog in the first place. Because I myself have always had a wide variety of views, economically progressive, but more culturally conservative. Not anti-open borders. And Robert Lindsay, while I don't agree with him on everything, he provided an outlet in many ways because there's not too many people who actually harbor my kind of combination of views.
Yeah, I mean, you use the word conservative, but you're not totally down on, like, we talked about this in our last interview, but you're not totally down on the stereotypical right-wing economics, Reaganomics.
Oh, I mean, as a millennial, you'd have to be insane to actually endorse the kind of right-wing Reaganomics that have been promoted in this country for the past three decades.
Yeah, it's a generation gap, but I mean, that's why you don't see that many millennials in the Tea Party, and the liberals are saying, I think liberals are like, oh, millennials are all liberal, and they want... Millennials are all liberal and they support us, but I think there is a market for millennials in an alternative movement, but the reason millennials aren't in the Tea Party is not because millennials want, like, more immigration. It's because they have no use for that, like the Reaganomics economic theories.
Oh yeah. I mean, same thing with libertarianism. When you have such a scarcity of jobs, and most of the new jobs created are these demeaning part-time food service industry type of jobs, the libertarian idea of the free market where American workers ought to compete against those in the third world at minimum wages, lunacy, just sheer lunacy. So I don't think millennials are necessarily liberal per se. I mean, sure, on certain pet causes like gay marriage or social issues, that they might be more liberal, but...
And that's... Gay marriage is like... I see it as purely a symbolic issue. I mean, a lot of people are outraged about gay marriage, but I don't really see it... I see it as purely symbolic. I don't see it as, like, destroying heterosexuality. That's kind of silly.
Well, I mean, as I pointed out in one of my older posts, I've always regarded gay marriage as either a leftist pet cause or a Republican wedge issue. Because gays are, what, maybe 3%, at most maybe 5% of the population. Whether or not they can get married will not have significant ramifications on the country as a whole. And yet our elites continue to push this gay marriage battle and distract us from far more important issues.
And on to the millennial thing, I mean, you have an article about the generation gap, about the land of the fat, home of the bus, baby boomers, and economic malaise. And it's back, you talk about the kind of the theme about millennials, or how millennials are lazy and spoiled. And it reminds me of Bill O'Reilly is like, he's always going on these rants like, I worked really hard to get to where I am. And all these young people today, they're just lazy, and they're on the internet all day, and you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah, and here's the thing, I'm not actually going to deny that a lot of the charges against millennials are true. I'll admit it, a lot of millennials are indeed a bunch of feckless social media addicts and video gamers and whatnot. But here's the thing. Millennials did not crash the global economy. Millennials were not handed the most prosperous civilization in the history of the planet on a silver platter and then went on to turn it into a wasteland. I mean, millennials did not cause the housing bubble. Millennials did not launch disastrous wars in Iraq. So, I mean, in many ways, the crimes of the baby boomers are all the more condemnable because they were basically given everything, as George Carlin once put it. You know, they were, college was dirt cheap back in their day. Opportunities abounded. You know, they didn't have the NSA constantly, you know, snooping on them. You know, boys back then weren't being doped up on Ritalin constantly. So, you know, the time they grew up in was in many ways a lot more freer and prosperous. So I'm not denying the hard work of individual boomers, but let's be real here. They were afforded a lot more opportunities than millennials were.
And they were the ones, you said in your article, they made free love, drugs, and drug use as the defining feature of a rebellion.
Well, essentially, yeah. I mean, rebellion was the defining feature of their generation, and yet they now have the audacity to criticize today's young people for not being responsible.
I guess some of the millennials are spoiled, but they basically raised the millennials as they are. And as far as being lazy, I mean, can you blame someone for being lazy and being on the internet all day if there's no incentive to work hard and to achieve what the quote-unquote American dream? I mean, can you really blame someone for being lazy if the incentive is not there?
Well, I mean, from someone's own personal standpoint, it's still a good idea to try to work hard and better your station life.
Yeah, but I mean, first of course.
I mean, but ultimately I agree with you because people need incentives. And the problem is that, I know I'm going to probably repeat several manosphere tropes here, but essentially society wants men to continue assuming all the traditional responsibilities of manhood, but without offering them the same benefits or incentives. Essentially, we're supposed to sacrifice, but without any expectation of reward. It's kind of weird. We're told to sacrifice for society, but at the same time, we're simultaneously being told that society doesn't owe you anything. So, well, if that's true, then why do we owe society anything?
And that's what mainstream conservatives are saying. Like, mainstream conservatives are saying society doesn't owe you anything, but you're entitled to contribute to society. You're required to contribute to society.
Yeah, it's always the focus on the everyday people. They're the ones who have to change and who have to man up. But there's almost nothing said about our amoral elites who continue to essentially pollute our society, despite the fact that their mismanagement has resulted in more mass immigration, more economic inequality, etc. It's everyday people who have to be saddled the bill, who are sort of saddled with the bill. And to go back to the immigration topic, it's the same thing in that regard. It's our elites who are supporting coups in Latin America. It's our elites who are fomenting a lot of instability in that region. And yet, rather than actually conducting a more humane and just foreign policy towards these various countries, they're instead just encouraging people to come live here and saddle everyday white Americans with the bill. So, in many ways, immigration or mass immigration can be regarded as a form of class warfare waged by elites on the everyday white person.
Have you been following that whole incident with Slavoj Zizek?
With who?
Slavoj Zizek.
I don't think so. No.
Okay, that was a big thing in the news of his fame. He's been famous on he's been famous as a Marxist, but he plagiarized American Renaissance. But since you haven't been following that, I guess we can move on to something else.
Sure.
So, I guess this ties in with what we're talking about. I got this comment you wrote. It was a comment on an interview I did with Robert Lindsay, and I'll read you your comment on, you said, and this is what you wrote in reference to the interview I did with Robert Lindsay. Life isn't a race, you know. Well, Robert Lindsay was like, life isn't a race, you know. We all end up in the same place at the in the end. And then you say, unfortunately, American society as a whole doesn't endorse your view. Ever since Reagan and neoliberalism, we really do live in a sink or swim type society where nobody gives a crap about anyone and more people are made to suffer in silence, especially men. And of course, the whole Calvinist mentality in our culture that promotes that view that failure is always your fault, economic, sexual, otherwise, doesn't help. What were you trying to get at by that comment?
Well, what I'm trying to get at is that our society as a whole has essentially deteriorated. You know, jobs have been outsourced, income inequality is soaring, and yet there's still this American mentality that, you know, you have to be this aggressive go-getter or this trailblazing entrepreneur, and that if you don't fail, it's always your fault. And so we still have this same Calvinist mentality, even though all the factories and manufacturing jobs of the Puritan work ethic age have gone the way of the dodo. So yet again, we're still sort of expected to conform to traditional societal norms, but at the same time, society as a whole has decayed, and society as a whole is basically just giving a big FU to the masses. So yet again, we're expected to sacrifice, but we're not given the same incentives. And this kind of strain can take its toll on many people. And occasionally, they go postal to wax Mark Ames.
Yeah, I remember I interviewed Matt Forney about that book. You listened? Did you hear that one?
I did.
Okay. Yeah. And so why do you think people are going postal so much these days?
Well, I think the American cultural mentality that you're either a success or you're a pathetic loser, along with the fact that American society in general just feels very unfree and dysfunctional compared to other industrialized Western nations in many ways. NSA surveillance, the highest rate of incarcerated citizens, you know, the IRS being used as a weapon, and so many other things. It just feels like society is increasingly becoming fragmented and more draconian. And of course, Fred Reed also once wrote an excellent article about how everything is becoming increasingly feminized, regulated, safe. There's just no real outlet for adventure or, you know, true trailblazing anymore. Everything just feels very sanitized, and it can drive some people crazy.
And you get people, they feel absolute emptiness and an absolute sense of nihilism.
Yeah.
And the first comment, you commented on that interview about I did it for Robert Lindsay about the spree shooting, and you said that
Elliot Rodger.
Yeah, Elliot Rodger. You said it was the right amount of nuance, as opposed to the sort of you said it's the right amount of nuance.
Right. Because, I mean, sometimes you get this idea that from the manosphere and other places that there's two classes of men. Either you're this go-getter, confident, charismatic alpha who gets all the ladies, or you're some loser beta or omega male. And as Dota pointed out in one of his articles, The Portrait of the Alpha Male, a lot of these depictions of masculinity are very superficial. You know, sometimes beta males have their alpha moments and vice versa, and there's a lot more to the male experience than just this simplistic notion of alpha.
Well, those manosphere types, the thing about it is, I mean, they are dissenting, but they're still a product of the culture.
Right.
So they're going to still have the same themes of popular culture. I mean, I made the same thing. I don't want to go off on a tangent about this, but with my last guest, I talked about people who become neo-Nazis and they adopt the Hollywood image. I think the neo-Nazis who adopt the Hollywood image, the same is true as the manosphere, is they adopt the stereotypes of popular culture. And I think that's the key, is a lot of people just, they lack nuance, and that, you said that the interview I did of Robert Lindsay really, it didn't come across that way at all.
No, and I think Robert does sort of approach the issue with the right level of nuance, because he's, as by his own admission, he's been on both sides of the barricades. He's been sort of a gamma, to use his words, and he's been a ladies' man. So he's sort of seen both sides, and he sort of knows that, you know, life is not as simple as, you know, top 10% of alpha males versus everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, human beings have a very, they have many different sides to them.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any specific thoughts on Elliot Rodgers himself?
Well, essentially, I was thinking of writing a post about Elliot Rodgers a couple months ago, but I decided against it because I figured that everyone else had already written about him, and I didn't think I would actually add anything new to the discussion. But what I will say about Rodgers is that I feel like he's society's cross to bear, because think about it. There's always been shy, socially awkward men like Elliot Rodgers. There's always been mentally ill people and the availability of weapons in this country. And yet only recently do you see these types of Elliot Rodgers murders, which ought to suggest that something about society is off. Because, you know, sane people in sane societies do not commit these types of murders.
And what would you say about the type of environment that he grew up in?
Well, from what I've gathered, he was the son of some rich Hollywood director. I believe he worked on The Hunger Games. And it seemed like he was in the worst possible environment for someone of his disposition. And that's actually what the commenter Tullio pointed out as well. Since Roger was naturally shy, introverted, and socially awkward, Santa Barbara, which is renowned for being a major party school...
I live in Santa Barbara.
Oh, yeah. And it's definitely not a place for shy introverts like Roger. I mean, it's a big party school. It sort of celebrates that extroverted party animal type. I mean, like Tullio said, Roger would have been better off if he had gone to teach English in a place like Asia, you know, where half white, half Asian people like him would have been a local celebrity.
Where even the Bay Area more so than Santa Barbara. I mean, there's tons of half Asian people in the Bay Area. I think he might have fit in there more so than Santa Barbara. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, probably. But the Bay Area also has a lot of wealth and opulence, and Roger thought that his BMW and nice wardrobe could win him the ladies, but when you're in a region where everyone else is driving a BMW and is affluent, well, it's not really going to make much of a difference.
And I see this type of stuff as a trend. I think these type of events are only going to get worse. And people are talking about how to prevent it, when there be gun control, but I just think a society is pretty fucked up. If you look at the response there, when that happened, there were large numbers of people, like on the chan, there's a site called 4chan, and there's all these people on there praising him, and it shows you just how disconnected so many people are. When you have a lot of people sympathizing with people like that.
Right, and thanks to your interview with Matt Forney, I actually did some of my own independent research on Mark Ames, and what Ames pointed out was that there was actually a lot of sympathy for the Columbine killers and various other rage killers as well, even though it tended to be more underground.
And I think there's more to it. I think my critique of the manosphere is they make it all about sex. I think there's something much deeper to it. The manosphere types make everything about sex, everything about fucking.
Yeah, I kind of get that vibe. I mean, there are some who buck the trend like Danger and Play and others who focus on other things, but
and
not,
oh,
that
you mentioned
general.
That, yes, because I have never, I didn't know that blog until you linked to it, Danger and Play.
Yeah, I feel like he's one of the more refreshing voices in the manosphere who tends to focus on things other than just sex, like fitness and lifestyle and healthy eating. And I think it's good to have some alternative voices like that. And in one of his tweets in response to the whole Roger massacre, he even said something to the effect that, you know, who teaches men like Roger that having a girlfriend makes you a failure? My message is that your value as a man is independent of any woman's approval. And I think we need more messages like that and less
of...
Yeah, oh.
I mean, you know what? A lot of, like, I know I'm going to... I'm sort of playing a devil's advocate, but, like, you have the feminists saying that the feminists are saying the manosphere contributes to people like Elliot Rodgers, but I'll be brutally honest, they do have a point, because that I think that mentality in the manosphere could contribute to someone. There's aspects of the manosphere that could contribute to someone like Elliot Rodgers, so they do have a point.
Well, it could contribute, but I wouldn't say it's a decisive factor.
No, not decisive, but it... But the mentality could.
Yeah, to an extent. But I just think that, because if you look at this from a standpoint of world history, having large masses of frustrated, disaffected men never bodes well for society. For example, in China, during the late Qing Dynasty, you had a group of unmarried men known as Bear Branches who would often join these radical movements or join these violent movements and generally cause disorder in society. And if you look at medieval Iranian history, one of the popular figures of that era was a Zoroastrian priest named Mazdak, who apparently gained a lot of followers because he promised wealth distribution and the sharing of women, sort of implying that men at the top had these large harems and were monopolizing a lot of the available pussy. So when you have large masses of frustrated men, well, society, for its own good, ought to do something to address it.
And this was before, this was in Iran before Islam.
Yeah.
And yeah, and the same thing in the Arab world today, where these men who become jihadis.
Oh yeah, and I mean, you know, because of their Spartan lifestyles, I can't help but think that that plays a minor role in contributing to their rage.
It's kind of like Robert Lindsay had a post comparing it to socialism.
What do you mean exactly?
I think Robert Lindsay was like was talking sexual socialism. Because he's a big socialist.
Oh, sexual Marxism.
Robert Lindsay's like he's a Marxist.
Guess he's a Marxist in all regards. But actually, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because what both Kevin MacDonald and Jared Taylor have argued is that one of the unique features of Western civilization was enforced monogamy, which sort of prevented men at the top from amassing harems and also enabled most men to marry and contribute, sort of give them an incentive.
It's called case selection versus R selection, and the same could be basically Europe and Northeast Asia, like Japan. I'm not sure about China, but Japan, those countries have been more case selected throughout history.
Yeah. And well, it kind of shows in their social structure.
And, and the places like Africa and the Arab world are so fucked up.
Well, I think that those regions have problems that extend beyond sexual frustration, but, yeah, it's probably a problem there.
And onto a totally different topic, you have this post, The Donors Behind Cultural Crimes, Why the Alternative Right Should Embrace Political Independence. What do you mean by political independence specifically?
Well, essentially, what I mean is that power in this country should actually reside with its elected officials who are ultimately accountable to the democratic process. Instead, what we have is a lot of politicians essentially being bought, because recent Supreme Court rulings have essentially declared that individuals can donate as much money to any political cause as they please. And when you combine that with previous Supreme Court rulings that basically afford corporations the rights of individuals, well, what you're essentially doing is legalizing bribery and making it our democratic system more and more perverted. So by removing money from the equation and by having publicly allocated funds to these politicians, we could actually make them accountable to the people. And that way, a lot of white conservatives could actually get their various demands addressed, because the current Republican Party, beholden to its corporate base, is not going to shut down the borders or address the concerns of various white American border
advocates. Yeah, it's all about Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Sheldon Adelson was especially shameful when he was imploring the Republicans to show compassion in this debate. Yeah, too bad he doesn't extend that to the Palestinians.
And not just the Palestinians. I mean, I'm sure he treats his own workers like crap. I mean, that's why he's so anti-union, because he wants to treat his workers the lowest working conditions possibly allowed under the law.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, one of the recurring themes of our blog, and probably much of the alternative right in general, is the idea that these various open borders advocates and other social justice types are essentially useful idiots for our big business elites. Because how can you claim to fight poverty and inequality and at the same time enthusiastically support the importation of legions of poor people and uneducated people who will only add to our already growing inequality, not to mention that their presence will add more people to the labor pool and make job competition even more intense among Americans. So, yeah, some progressivism, huh?
Yes, that post, render enter Cesar, lessons from Cesar Chavez, and he was against. Does the movie, well, you saw the movie about Cesar Chavez, does the movie admit that he was against illegal immigration?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, the movie was purely a hagiographic film, so it only showed
So you wouldn't recommend spending the money to go out and rent it?
Not the money, no, but I'd see it for free when they show it on TV.
Yeah.
But essentially, they only showed the life of Cesar Chavez up until his first major victory, where he forced the growers to negotiate, but they don't show his activism after that. They didn't show his activism against illegal immigration. They didn't show the UFW's deterioration following his departure, or how he didn't really establish the infrastructure necessary to keep the organization going. So, yeah, it was purely a hagiographic film.
So, before I wrap up, I want to ask you, where do you and Dota see your site Occident Invicta? Where do you see it going in the future? Do you plan on sort of continuing writing on the same subjects, or do you have anything you'd like to do in the future that you haven't done in the past?
Well, one of the things that we've started brainstorming is actually potentially publishing a book, which is sort of a combination of compilations of our articles with various other ideas. We're thinking of calling it something along the lines of Manufacturing Grievances, the Unholy Alliance of Plutocrats and Social Justice Warriors. And we'll have chapters covering feminism, multiculturalism, mass immigration, and various other issues.
There has not been a book on that. There is a, you know what it reminds me of? There are similarities. Kerry Bolton has a book called Babel, Inc., which is about the similar theme. But I think you could do something that's totally unique. But I would, if you haven't read that book, I would suggest read Kerry Bolton's Babel, Inc., because it's basically about the same thing you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely hate to come up with our own ambitious publishing project only to realize that someone's already done the exact same thing. So yeah, we're thinking of that, and we'll continue writing and hopefully maybe even potentially attract guest writers to help expose people to a wider variety of viewpoints.
And also, I would say trying to reach people beyond the alternative right, people who are not already in the alternative right, finding ways of reaching people
exactly
from different niches.
And, because ultimately, we have to reach out to everyday people if we want to succeed. That's why I've sort of, in my latest posts, I've refrained from using these esoteric buzzwords like cultural Marxism or the like, because...
Or the worst thing you could do is the movement-tard stuff, like the people who talk about the 14 words, that's like...
Oh, God.
No.
I mean, if you were to approach the everyday white person in the street and just throw out the word cultural Marxism, they'd probably look at you like, what are you talking about?
I used to use that term a lot on my show, but I try to cut down on those buzzwords.
I mean, the same thing goes for manosphere terms like hypergamy or the like. You know, you don't want to use the esoteric buzzwords that are just going to fly
over
people's
heads. I talked about that with my – you must have listened to my Matt Forney show I did because we talked about that.
Not the latest one, actually, no.
Yeah, just the internet. All these words going on the internet, just find a way to communicate your message where you can talk to the – average man on the street.
Yeah, because ultimately their numbers will have to swell our movement if we want to enjoy any measure of success.
And I joked about this the last time, but like the average guy, he cares about getting paid and getting laid. He doesn't care about the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, I don't think he wouldn't know who Herbert Marcuse was.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, a lot of these intellectual discussions are very edifying, but at some point you do have to move beyond the echo chamber.
So, Bay Area guy, it's been a great show.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.